Hello, welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, November 4. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, A New Life, this story by Elijah Desius. With nothing more than the clothes on their back, a duffel bag of belongings, and hope for a new future after escaping the Taliban's grip, Afghan refugees have begun arriving at the Eastern Iowa Airport. Last Friday, Zia Zakhail and Shakil Safi were the fifth and sixth refugees from Afghanistan to arrive in Cedar Rapids since the Taliban's rapid takeover in August, according to the Catherine McCauley Center. Two more, a father and son, arrived Saturday. The first new Afghan refugee arrived here October 16. If the nonprofit's capacity estimate for Afghan refugees from October holds true, Cedar Rapids can expect 117 more over the next fiscal year. That's in addition to 300 refugees from other countries the center already volunteered to help before the latest crisis mounted in Afghanistan. With little information to go on other than a name, case managers await each arrival, watching for the distinctive bag that identifies each. A plastic International Organization for Migration bag. Caseworker Celestin Nagaji recognized it immediately as the same bag he received when he came from Rwanda 25 years ago, one of the first articles of freedom refugees tout upon arrival. Having little more than a name, birth date, language spoken, and information about a refugee's family or friends in the area, the Catherine McCauley Center first evaluates whether it can accept a request for resettlement from federal authorities. Typically, the center receives 1 to 3 weeks' notice ahead of travel plans, but sometimes less. Little advance notification is likely for Afghan refugees, according to Sarah Zeznik, Director of Refugee and Immigration Services at the nonprofit. With the nature of the Afghanistan government's quick collapse, the process of Afghan refugees is ever-changing and fluid, according to Stephanie Morris, director of the Refugee Alliance of Central Iowa. Iowa has been a leader in refugee resettlements since the 1970s, she said. For the most part, our resettlement agencies feel very welcome to new Iowans. Before these refugees arrive, they are processed at military bases throughout the country or overseas. Zakhail recently spent weeks at a base in New Mexico, for example. Many are sent to cities where they have families or friends. Those without ties in the country are assigned a location. After refugees step off their last flight, they are settled into their new home cities through organizations like the Catherine McCauley Center, which are contracted by the federal government. This year, there are some challenges and changes to navigate, housing being perhaps the biggest. We're fully aware that housing stock in Cedar Rapids is extremely low after the derecho, Zeznik said. We're trying to balance that support we're providing to Afghans who are entering the community with knowing there are people who really need housing in our community as it is. To help with that, a rule that typically limits agencies to housing refugees within a 50 to 100 mile radius of their office has been lifted, clearing the way for housing and employment opportunities in smaller towns outside the metro area, like Fairfield and Muscatine. Zeznik said the organization has been having conversations with those communities to ensure successful placements. We can readily find 1 and 2 bedrooms, but not a ton of 3 and 4 bedroom apartments, said Carrie True Funk, field office director of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants in Des Moines. That often presents a challenge for multi-generational families or families with several children. This year, the Des Moines organization has volunteered to take 125 refugees. By comparison, it has settled 112 Afghans since 2014. This process is a little outside the norm, True Funk said. Some Afghan arrivals may be classified as humanitarian parolees instead of refugees, which in the past had limited the help available to them. Because of a resolution passed through Congress and signed October 1 by President Joe Biden, Humanitarian parolees now can receive access to the same programs and services as refugees, like employment training, case management, and temporary assistance benefits. Our job is to create that foundation for a successful life in the United States, she said. Our preference is to get people as self-sufficient as quickly as possible. With a tight labor market in Iowa, she anticipates Afghans will be welcomed by businesses searching for workers. One of the largest limiting factors in determining the agency's capacity to resettle refugees is the number of case managers available. True Funk said the number of case managers drastically shrunk with historically large budget cuts to refugee programming under the Trump administration. In 2016, the Des Moines agency had 5 case managers. By summer, it was down to 1. Before that, was increased to 3. We'll be recruiting soon for increased staffing to provide support to that population, Zejnik said. With a majority of Cedar Rapids refugees coming from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Burundi, she said Afghans will diversify the local immigrant population. After a wane of bipartisan support for refugees in recent years, refugee resettlement leaders in Iowa are finding a window of opportunity to rebuild support for those seeking a new life as Americans. Afghans help U.S. military members, she said. It bridged the political divide a bit more. The resettlement program has for a long time received bipartisan support. She noticed the loss of support after the Syrian refugee crisis came to the forefront in 2015. But after the dramatic decline in support, she said leaders are hoping Afghans can get the U.S. refugee program back on track. That is certainly my goal and the sentiment of conversations I've had with other resettlement partners across the country, she said. This is an opportunity to seize the support of more business leaders, landlords, and lay the foundation for building bipartisan support of our program. Also on the front page this morning, this story by Marissa Payne. Tight vote clouds mayor runoff rivalry. O'Donnell faces either Andrews or Hart in a November 30 runoff election in Cedar Rapids. Most Cedar Rapids voters decided Tuesday it's time for a change in leadership of Iowa's second largest city. But as voters narrowed a 4-way race for mayor, Tiffany O'Donnell rose to the top to guarantee a spot in a November 30 runoff election, while Amara Andrews finished with just a slim lead in unofficial results over incumbent Brad Hart, casting uncertainty over who will take the second spot on the ballot. No candidate reached the necessary 50% of the vote to win outright. So the two top vote-getters have less than a month to vie for the city's top elected role. Women Lead Change Chief Executive Officer O'Donnell emerged with over 40% of the vote, 10,991 total. But there is a possibility that a batch of 112 provisional ballots cast countywide, likely most of them coming from Cedar Rapids, could sway who gets to be in second place. As it stands, True North employee Andrews edged out Hart by 24 votes to finish second, with 7,332, according to the unofficial results. Quaker Oats employee Myra Colby Bradwell finished last in the race with 411. Results are subject to a final canvass by the Linn County Board of Supervisors, likely to be Tuesday before being official. O'Donnell has campaigned on finishing derecho cleanup and accelerating flood control on both sides of the Cedar River. She also has centered on recruitment and retention of workers and businesses, as well as creating a more vibrant urban center surrounded by unique neighborhoods. I just couldn't be happier about how it turned out, and I hope that it's a bit of a referendum on how we want to see campaigns run, O'Donnell said. We have to be if we're tired of divisiveness in politics. We have an opportunity to be the change, and this is our opportunity. If elected, Andrews would be the city's first black mayor and the first black woman on the 9-member city council. She has campaigned as a progressive Democrat in a field of registered Republicans who have bristled at bipartisanship influencing the race and bristled at partisanship influencing the race and maintained that there is no place for party politics in the nonpartisan positions. Andrews' platform centers on fostering more public input in city decisions and operations, supporting and partnering with nonprofits to address unmet needs, and having a path for equitable recovery from the 2020 derecho and the pandemic. Despite the attacks on me, likely referring to news coverage of a legal dispute over a home she and her husband had built in Illinois, we still have lots of support, and so we will hope to prevail in 28 days, Andrews said in a brief interview Tuesday night with the Gazette. Campaign disclosure reports filed October 28, the most recent filings before the election, showed O'Donnell raising $136,770 and had the highest cash total raised from Cedar Rapids donors. She reported $13,045.79 cash on hand. Andrews had raised $181,440, two-thirds of the from out-of-state donors, though she had the most Cedar Rapids contribution, and $16,945.10 on hand. The candidate elected to the part-time role of mayor will begin his or her four-year term at noon, January 1, 2022. The position pays about $39,000 a year. Surrounded by supporters, friends, and family at her watch party Tuesday at Lucky's in Czech Village, O'Donnell said over the next 4 weeks she will meet with voters and listen to their hopes, dreams, and challenges to identify how she could best move the city forward if elected. We have to make sure that we continue to work toward a better, brighter Cedar Rapids, she said. Should the results stand and Andrews proceeds into the runoff over the next 4 weeks, Andrews campaign manager Sarah Halbrook said in a statement, "We all know that turnout is the name of the game in runoff elections. We have the resources on hand, the ability to scale quickly, and we are confident that our team will get it done once again." Andrews, in a statement Wednesday, said she expected a clean issues-based campaign moving forward. The voters should decide whether they want more of the same conservative status quo leadership that puts the interests of large corporate giants over those of working people, or if they're ready for real change, Andrews said. While campaigning against O'Donnell, a former news anchor for CBS 2 Fox 28, the Andrews campaign has criticized news reporting on Andrews' Illinois legal dispute and potential ethics violations stemming from an anti-O'Donnell mailer, urging supporters to ignore the noise and focus on Andrew's vision. Hart said in a text Wednesday, "I don't have any plans yet and haven't really discussed it. When the canvass is finished and the provisional ballots and military absentee ballots are counting, I will make a plan." Declined to answer whether he would commit to not requesting a recount. It is unclear whether Hart would endorse a successor if he is officially counted out of a runoff, but Hart's team campaigned against Andrews, sending texts in the days before the election, directing people at KWWL-TV stories about the legal dispute and campaign mailer. The 112 provisional ballots will be reviewed Thursday at a precinct board meeting, said Linn County Auditor Joel Miller. This is a preliminary number. There were 241 undervotes and 11 overvotes reported in the race out of 26,104 votes, which Miller said typically indicates people were upset, confused, or did not want to vote in a race. There could be more such votes among those provisional ballots. Military and overseas ballots likely would be a small factor in the race, Miller said. As of Sunday, the auditor's office had issued only 11 overseas ballots, and two had come back. One returned Wednesday and may not qualify, he said, and he did not expect to receive many, if any, additional ballots. Candidates would have until 5 p.m. Wednesday after the canvass to request a recount, Miller said, but cautioned strongly against anyone seeking one. By the time results are certified, the runoff will likely be just 21 days away. With Linn County turnout nearly 28% Tuesday, Miller said that means 72% of voters didn't participate, Once a recount notice is filed, there's no going back, he said. You could theoretically end up with a very small subset of the voters that voted Tuesday voting for the mayor on November 30, Miller said. I hope if someone is thinking about a recount that they give it some long, hard thought as to what the repercussions are going to be in the end. And also on the front page, this by Michaela Ram, COVID-19 shots start for Iowa children. Young Iowans began receiving COVID-19 vaccinations Wednesday after federal officials approved shots for children ages 5 to 11, clearing the way for a new phase of vaccine distribution in Iowa. Pediatricians, pharmacies, and other vaccine providers across the state have begun administering shots to this age group, with doses from advanced allocations that arrived, in some cases, just hours before the vaccine received emergency use authorization. That included a handful of providers in the corridor who were distributing pediatric doses during vaccine clinics Wednesday evening. More than 26,000 of the state's initial 99,000 allocated pediatric doses were delivered in the state Wednesday, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The remaining doses are expected to arrive in the coming days. To local health officials, the federal approval this week and the quick launch of this new phase of vaccine distribution marked a huge step in the continued effort to curb community transmission of the coronavirus. It is a pretty monumental day to curb household, school, and daycare transmission, and I'm sure a huge relief to so many families, said Sam Jarvis, community health manager at Johnson County Public Health. On Tuesday evening, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention signed off on the Pfizer vaccine for children between 5 and 11 years old, clearing the way for the shots to start going into the arms of an estimated 28 million young Americans. The approved COVID-19 dose for children is about one-third of the dose administered for adults and teens. In Iowa, about 284,000 children in that age group now are eligible to be fully vaccinated. That includes an estimated 20,294 children in Linn County and about 11,700 in Johnson County. Local public health officials warn COVID-19 vaccine appointments for this age group may be limited until later this week or early next week as providers review state guidance for administering these shots. At the moment, the limiting factor has been whether the vaccine was delivered yesterday and providers were able to prep for a start date today, Jarvis said. However, based on the current supply, parents eager to immunize their children should expect to do so in the near future. We've come a long way, said Heather Meter, clinical supervisor for Linn County Public Health. Conversations happening last year at this time were much different. We're in a much better place now. The COVID-19 vaccine will be available to children at most vaccine providers, including healthcare clinics and retail pharmacies, Meter said. Vaccine clinics will be available to students in school districts in Linn and Johnson counties. On Wednesday, the Iowa City Community School District announced a partnership with the Visiting Nurses Association to host walk-in COVID-19 vaccine clinics for students at 10 of its elementary schools in the coming weeks. Shots will be provided only to students with a parent or guardian present. The first vaccine clinics are scheduled for 3:15 to 6 p.m. Monday. The clinics will be held at Grant Elementary, 1000 Central Way in North Liberty, and Weber Elementary, 3850 Rarrett Road in Iowa City. The Iowa City School District also is working with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics to arrange vaccine clinics with interpreters and transportation to night clinics, Iowa City Superintendent Matt Degner said at a school board meeting last week. We feel like our families should have some choice and accessibility, he said. In addition, the Cedar Rapids Community School District is working with Linn County Public Health to host clinics as part of an effort to increase access for families, particularly those who might face barriers in taking their children to a vaccine appointment. Meter said details on those events should be coming in the next couple of weeks. COVID-19 vaccine appointments are filling rapidly for now. As time goes on this week and next, we anticipate more appointments becoming available and ask that parents and guardians not get discouraged while in the process of scheduling, Jarvis said. Turning to the Iowa Today page, the decision delayed on where to hold state volleyball tournament, this by Aaron Jordan. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union will wait until January to decide whether the state volleyball tournament in Cedar Rapids or to keep the state tournament in Cedar Rapids or move it to Coralville. Athletic Union board members decided at a meeting Wednesday they want to gather more information about netting systems, scoreboards, seating, and nearby hotels for the competing venues before making a decision. They noted how Cedar Rapids businesses had lighted buildings pink to welcome the tournament Monday through Thursday at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in downtown Cedar Rapids, which has hosted the state competition for 31 years. But the welcome hasn't always been this warm, board members said. They could have been doing some of these things the past few years to say, hey, we love you. This is valuable to our community, and not just rallying the troops because this is a decision-making year for us, said Deanne Kramer, a board member and athletic director at Pleasant Valley High School. It is a big decision for us, Union Executive Director Gene Berger said. While the most recent contract between the union and the Cedar Rapids venue was for 10 years, the union is considering a 5-year or 10-year contract for this next round. The group plans to gather additional information and weigh which venue is better for players, coaches, fans, and administrators. The group expects to make a decision at its January 12 meeting in Des Moines. The 4-day, 40-team state volleyball tournament typically draws 28,000 to 30,000 people and generates about $2 million in consumer spending downtown as players and families stay at hotels, eat at restaurants, and buy gas for the drive home. Cedar Rapids and its partners, including the Powerhouse, DoubleTree Hilton Hotel, and Convention Center, the Metro Economic Alliance, and Venue Works submitted a proposal to the union earlier this fall. The 9,000-seat arena also hosts concerts, rodeos, boat shows, and professional basketball, soccer, and indoor football events. The other contender for the volleyball tournament is Coralville, which has the new Extreme Arena. The arena, home of the University of Iowa volleyball program and the Iowa Heartlanders minor league hockey team, seats 5,100 more with floor seats and has warm-up courts in the adjacent Green State Family Fieldhouse. The state volleyball tournament also has been good to the athletic union, which governs all girls' high school sports in Iowa. Greg Ebeling, outgoing board president and superintendent of Pella Community Schools, said Wednesday the tournament makes more money for the union than any other state tournament, including girls basketball. In other business, the athletic union board says it will move forward with the sanctioning process for girls wrestling now that more than 50 schools have formed teams. There are 50 schools that have full teams now, and others say they've put resources aside to grow that, said Aaron Kirtley, the athletic union associate director assigned to girls wrestling. Once that sanctioning decision is made, I could see another 22 schools saying, we're in. The athletic union will need to decide on a season and what to do with schools that only have a handful of athletes, among other questions, Berger said. Turning now to the Insight page, the Gazette's own editorial is titled, Ripples, But No Wave of Change. Local voters put few dents in the status quo during Tuesday's city and school elections. Yes, there is some ongoing drama in the Cedar Rapids mayoral race. Tiffany O'Donnell was the top vote-getter but failed to win 50% plus one majority, so the race is headed to a November 30 runoff election. There remains some question who she'll face. Amara Andrews clings to a 24-vote lead over Mayor Brad Hart, but there are provisional ballots and a possible recount ahead. But we doubt City Council approaches to issues such as housing, economic development, and public safety would change dramatically with O'Donnell in the mayor's seat, so her support is an indication Cedar Rapids voters prefer the city's current general direction. Incumbent Dale Todd was reelected to the Cedar Rapids Council, fending off a challenge from political newcomer Tamara Marcus. We hope Marcus, who is a climate scientist, will remain involved in local politics. The local option sales tax for street projects in Cedar Rapids was renewed, as was Linn County's effort to win a casino license. Iowa City voters re-elected Mayor Bruce Teague and elected Megan Alter to the City Council, choosing the sort of progressive candidates who have dominated City Hall for years. Jason Glass, who billed himself as an independent, fell short. We hope he continues to speak out on issues. Although school board races in other parts of Iowa were steered by national political issues and outside dollars, Cedar Rapids voters re-elected incumbents Nancy Humbles and Jennifer Borcherding. Marcy Roundtree, who has worked and volunteered for years in local schools, won the at-large seat. But one candidate, motivated by his opposition to mask mandates in school, Matt Rollinger, won a seat on the Linmar School Board. Also in Marion, Dale Monroe holds a one-vote lead over City Council incumbent Randy Sternad, pending a recount, yet more evidence that every vote counts. We endorse many of these incumbents, but not because we want them to be complacent. Healthy turnout indicates there is considerable public interest in how communities and community schools are being governed. Our leaders need to harness that interest and reward it with more transparency and responsiveness. School boards especially need to do more to involve parents in decision-making. We also hope after a mayoral campaign in Cedar Rapids, tinged in partisan attacks, we see a runoff campaign that brings the focus back to issues residents care about. And again, that's the Gazette's own editorial. And 24-Hour Doorman today is titled, "It Was Missteps, Not Media." So it's a runoff in Cedar Rapids' race for mayor. Deep breath. Tiffany O'Donnell cruised, but didn't top 50%. According to unofficial results reported Tuesday night, Amara Andrews beat Mayor Hart by 24 votes for the second spot. But that may change as provisional ballots are reviewed. O'Donnell would seem to be the favorite, but runoff elections can be unpredictable. If the results hold, Andrews still has a chance to make history as the city's first black mayor and only second black woman to guide a major metro area in Iowa. Despite the attacks on me, we still have lots of support and we will hope to prevail in 28 days, Andrews said in a brief interview with the Gazette's Marissa Payne. Andrews seems to be arguing media coverage damaged her chances, but I'd submit the damage was also self-inflicted. Payne wrote a detailed account of Andrews' past and present financial and legal problems. She's in an ongoing dispute with an Illinois home builder and is having her wages garnished after falling behind on payments called for in a settlement. The story first broke on the Republican website, Iowa Field Report, and was picked up later by KWWL. As news of Andrews' finances circulated this fall, the campaign prioritized damage control over candor. One good news conference could have put it to bed weeks ago. News also broke last week regarding Andrews' campaign fundraising, showing she raised a lot of money out of state. Among the 42 donations she received of 1,000 or more, 10 came from Iowa. Andrews' opponents released campaign finance numbers weeks ago, but Andrews declined and instead waited for the state filing deadline on October 28. Those campaign numbers also showed Andrews' campaign coordinated with a Democratic PAC to send out a mailer in the campaign's closing days, tying O'Donnell to Donald Trump, Governor Kim Reynolds, and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. The mailer was paid for by Iowa Voter Info, which it turned out was a PAC hastily constructed by local Democratic Central Committee members. So hastily they used the name of an existing organization, its mailing address, and the Central Committee's P.O. box. Asked by our editorial fellow Althea Cole about Iowa Voter Info, Andrews, her campaign consultant Stacy Walker, and the campaign chair Steve Shriver pleaded ignorance. Then the numbers came out showing Andrews' campaign donated $9,000 to Iowa Voter Info, which in turn spent $7,500 on the mailer. Shriver stepped down as campaign chair. Why go to the trouble of creating an arm's-length entity to deliver a message Andrews was already delivering? And with public disclosure looming, why not just tell the truth? Andrews is seeking to tap the city's large pool of Democratic voters. The strategy has been obvious. And O'Donnell, who uses a consulting firm headed by longtime Republican Party operatives, is hardly apolitical. But it's Andrews' campaign efforts to pretend otherwise that have proved most damaging. She now has the rest of November to reset her campaign, fine-tune her organization, and maybe make history. One community letter today, not voting is a choice, two. Another election day has come and gone. In the wake of recent electoral contests, the media will dutifully fill airtime, page space, and internet bandwidth telling stories about voter turnout. Such stories are told in the context of what percentage of eligible voters turned out to the polls and participated. We are conditioned to believe this version of the story, that voter turnout is always somewhere less than 100%. This way of thinking disenfranchises a huge swath of the population and enables generally unpopular politicians to sail to victory with only 20% to 25% of the total population supporting them. What we forget in counting voters is that non-voting is a choice too, a choice that says none of the above and stays home. Sadly, these votes are never counted in an election. The next time you see an overwrought, hand-wringing story about voter turnout, don't join the collective knee-jerk reaction to shame such people. Ask instead why we keep running such unattractive candidates that repel such people from the polls out of sheer disgust. Perhaps politics can be fixed by finally counting non-voters' votes as part of the official tally and assigning real-world electoral implications to those votes. And that's signed by Matthew Rothschild from Marion. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, November 4, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. First in the short notices from Cedar Rapids, Don Hamus, age 91, died Wednesday, November 3. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. From Garnavillo, Faye Elizabeth Walls, age 92, died Tuesday, November 2. Took Allen Funeral Home, Garnavillo. In Iowa City, Claire Wicks, age 87, died Tuesday, November 2. Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Liberty. From Nichols, Lewis P. Peterson, 93, died Wednesday, November 3. Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Liberty. And in one other death, Terry Lee Faulkner, age 47, of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, died Tuesday, November 2. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Prairie du Chien. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Darren Patrick Olson, age 52, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, October 30. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 5 at Cedar Memorial Park State Room. A funeral mass will take place at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 6 at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church, officiated by the Reverend Ken Glaser. Burial will take place at Mount Calvary Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Alice Marie Schumacher, age 97, passed away Monday, November 1 at Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids. Iowa Cremation is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Lois Ann Wilson Woods, 79, passed away at the Promise House in Hiawatha, November 3, from complications due to a stroke initially suffered in March. Rosary is offered at 3:30 p.m. with visitation from 4 to 7, Friday, November 5, with a vigil service at 6:30 at the Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass is at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 6th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids, with Father Ball presiding. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. All are welcome to attend and celebrate Lois's beautiful life. From Oxford, Lavona M. Cadera Wood is at peace. She departed this earth on November 2 under the direction of Iowa City Hospice and with the direct care of Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg. Visitation for Lavona will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 6th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford. A Mass of Christian burial will follow at 10:30 a.m. The interment will be held at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Oxford. The family wishes to extend their appreciation to the staff at Highland Ridge and Iowa City Hospice. Memorials may be directed to the Oxford Fire Department or Iowa City Hospice. Lansing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Sioux City, Terrence W., known as Terry Hersom, died Sunday, October 31, at the age of 71, at the age of 71 years, 2 months and 5 days, he passed away in Chicago. A visitation will be from 1 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 8, at the Christie Smith Funeral Home, Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue. The family will be present from 4 to 7 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 9, at the Modern-day Parish Church of the Nativity. Burial to follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. A celebration of Terry's life will be 6 to 10 p.m. Tuesday at Bob Rose Point After. Online condolences can be left for the family at christysmith.com. And our final obituary from Richmond, Illinois, Dean C. Chalid, age 83, passed away Saturday, October 30, at his residence. Memorial visitation will be from 11 a.m. until the celebration of life at 1 p.m. Saturday, November 6th, at Grace Lutheran, 6000 Broadway, Richmond. The Reverend Andy Tyrell will officiate. Memorials in his name may be made to Grace Lutheran Church or to the Richmond Spring Grove Rotary to support their charitable organization. Moving now to the sports page, lots of girls volleyball stories. In today's finals in Class A, Cedar Falls at 32-8 will play Pleasant Valley at 10 a.m. In Class 4A, Western Dubuque at 33-3 plays Waverly Shell Rock 44-7, that game at 12:15. In Class 3A, West Liberty at 39-4 faces West Delaware 42-5 at 2:30 p.m. In Class 2A, Dyke New Hartford at 53-1 plays Western Christian 40-5, and that game's at 4:45 p.m. And in Class A, Burlington Notre Dame 37-8 faces Springville at 35-4. That game tips off at 7 p.m. Orioles earn their first shot at the title. This story by Mike Condon. Entering last night's Class 1A state semifinal with number 3 Springville, the number 14 Redhawks had taken out number 4 Lisbon in the regional finals and number 2 Lamar's Galen Catholic in the quarterfinals. Springfield was having none of that. Coach Claude Howard's Orioles dominated from start to finish, rolling to a 25-10, 25-12, 25-17 victory last night at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Springville will play in a state title match for the first time in school history tonight at 6 p.m. against number 1 Burlington Notre Dame, which swept Fort Madison Holy Trinity. And surviving a hiccup, this story by Jeff Linder, their celebratory sticker placement game could use some work. "We got too hyped," Maddie Harris said. "We couldn't handle the hype." Volleyball, though, the Western Dubuque Bobcats are masters at that. Number 1 Western Dubuque overcame a self-proclaimed mid-match hiccup and defeated number 5 Marion in a four-set Class 4A state tournament semifinal Wednesday afternoon. Scores were 25-19, 25-18, 17-25, and 25-15. "We had that hiccup. We ran our quick offense, and we got it back," senior Meredith Ball said. The Bobcats at 33-3 won their 25th consecutive match and advanced to face number 3 Waverly Shell Rock at 12:15 this afternoon with the 4A title at stake. Western Dubuque reached the final in 2019 and then fell in the semifinals last year. "It's nice to be back," Libby Lansing said. After the match, one of the players was trying to affix Western Dubuque's sticker to the proper line of a large tournament bracket. "But," Ball said, "we were so hyped, we were jumping up and down. Somebody pushed her and the whole easel went down." Western Dubuque was dynamite early, hitting .44, 13 kills against one error in 27 swings in the first set. In this Class 5A roundup, Pleasant Valley and Cedar Falls to battle. Carol Ruff said it was a set she could not remember experiencing during her 4-year career. In a high-stakes match against Ankeny on Wednesday in the Class 5A semifinals, the Spartans came through with an epic 32-30 win, breaking through on their 8th set point. "We've never played a set that has gone that far," said Ruff, Pleasant Valley's senior setter. "It just showed a lot of grit from our girls." Now, after finishing off a 25-16, 32-30, 15-25, 25-17 win over the Hawkettes, Ruff and her teammates have a chance to bring home the school's first state volleyball title. Number 2 Pleasant Valley will meet number 4 Cedar Falls today in that final. In 4A, the Gohawks earn a date with the Bobcats. This story by Mike Condon. Yvonne Wooden was emotional for many reasons, both professionally and personally. The veteran Waverly Shell Rock volleyball coach has taken many teams to the state tournament, but they haven't won a title since 2011. Wooden and her players now have a chance to end that drought. The Gohawks got 18 kills from Avery Beckett and survived an epic back-and-forth final set to post a 25-22, 19-25, 25-17, 32-30 win over North Scott in a Class 4A semifinal Wednesday afternoon at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Wooden's team at 44-7 will meet number 1 Western Dubuque at noon today in the state title match. The Bobcats advanced with a 4-set win over Marion. Turning to the Hoopla page, the front page has a feature of Dyersville Fields More Than Dreams and a photo accompanied by the huge church in Dyersville. Northeast Iowa town hits a home run with a movie site, the Basilica, farm toys, and more. This story by Diana Nolan. 4 miles northeast of town lies the reason many people come to Dyersville, but the Field of Dreams isn't the only major league attraction in this city of nearly 4,500 residents, lying 64 miles northeast of Cedar Rapids. As you turn off Highway 20, you'll see the twin spires of the Basilica of St. Francis Xavier soaring above the treetops at 212 feet each. Before you get there, you'll pass the National Farm Toy Museum, a point of pride for the city known as the Farm Toy Capital of the World. 44th annual National Farm Toy Show and Auction is so big, it will be spread over several sites this weekend. Whatever your interests, Dyersville, founded in the late 1840s, hits a home run. Field of Dreams. People will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway not knowing for sure why they're going. They'll arrive at your door as innocent as children longing for the past. That's a quote from James Earl Jones, wrapping up his mellifluous voice around the dialogue in Field of Dreams. The 1898 fantasy film that gave us the phrases, "If you build it, he will come," and "Is this heaven? No, it's Iowa," continues to capture the fancy of moviegoers, baseball fans, and the kids they want to introduce to the site where Hollywood met heaven. On October 27, they came from Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, on and on, leaving their signatures on the Field of Dreams guest book. Three generations of visitors sat on the wooden benches where, in the movie, Ray Kinsella, played by Kevin Costner, sat with his daughter Karen, Gabby Hoffman, to watch the ghost players emerge from the cornfield onto the battlefield. A mom and two kids smiled for selfies in front of the picture-perfect white farmhouse steps from the ball diamond. Others ducked into the bright red barn to check out the t-shirts and souvenirs in the baseballism store. Outside the barn, a guide in a replica vintage ball uniform waited for people to arrive for his next 30-minute house tour. If You Build It exhibit. Also closed for the season is the If You Build It for the exhibit, filling a corner storefront at 201 First Avenue East. It will reopen in May, and it rounds the bases with a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the movie, as well as the history that inspired W.P. Kinsella's 1982 novel, Shoeless Joe, which was adapted for the screen shortly thereafter. Of course, the Basilica is a draw. According to XavierBasilica.com history, the first Catholic church in Dyersville was built in 1862, just south of the Basilica. 7 years later, that first structure had to double in size to accommodate the Catholics moving into the area. By 1880, congregants had again outgrown the space, so construction of the current building began in September 1887. The Gothic-style structure was dedicated December 3, 1889, the feast day of St. Francis Xavier, for whom it is named. The interior painting was finished in 1905 and restored in 2000-2001. Thousands of people will flood Dyersville from Friday through Sunday for the 44th annual National Farm Toy Show and Auction, which begins at 10 a.m. Saturday at Beckman High School. A display contest will be held at the Beckman School Gym. More than 200 exhibitors from about 20 states will be selling toys and collectibles at the school, museum, two outdoor spaces east of the museum, and at the nearby Commercial Club Park. The annual Summer Farm Toy Show is held the first full weekend in June. And some other area attractions are the Dyer Botsford Historical House and Doll Museum, 331 First Avenue East, open May to November. Home to Dyersville founder James Dyer Jr. and his wife Anne and their three children, this restored Victorian structure looks like a life-size dollhouse. Visitors will see antique furniture, vintage wedding dresses, a miniature hand-carved circus, a rare German feather Christmas tree, Dyersville history displays, and more than 2,000 dolls. Also, the Heritage Trail is a 30-mile all-season trail that has trailheads at several Dubuque County towns. This former rail line beckons hikers, bikers, skiers, and snowmobilers through a valley 450 feet deep and past old mining and mill towns. Lodging is available, and of course dining too, as you enjoy all the attractions in Dyersville. In the food category, this article, On the Loose, by Elijah Desius. Barker's brings ice cream and a taste of Made Right history to the former Marion DQ site. The location that served as a Dairy Queen for decades is now serving much more than ice cream. Barker's Ice Cream and More, opened September 20 by owner Joe Hill, brings a variety of loose meat sandwiches, hot dogs, and higher butterfat ice cream to the table, with twisters, sundaes, malts, ice cream pies, and more. This establishment has never served food, so we're really trying to get the word out here about the food portion and draw people in for lunch and dinner, manager Terry Enta said. They already know they can come and get ice cream here. Opening later in the year than anticipated, Entis and Hill are hoping hungry Marionites will flock to 2100 7th Avenue for more than frozen treats as winter approaches. Unlike the former Dairy Queen, Barker's will be open all year. With Entis at the helm of the new restaurant, the loose meat sandwich is getting a fresh spin. It's an iconic sandwich to the state of Iowa, Entis said. She's hoping to capitalize on the sandwich's popularity with Iowans as well as her history with it. For 27 years, Entis helped run the Marion Maidrite, owned by her family. After that location closed, she said she couldn't adjust to a static desk job. She came back into the restaurant industry when Hill approached her with his idea. At Maidrite, the man she knew as a customer soon became a friend and now a business partner. The quality of sandwiches and chili dogs at Barker's starts with fresh, never frozen beef, the manager said. With no fryers, the restaurant is keeping sides simple for now with options like mashed potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, deviled egg potato salad, and mac and cheese. Everything is made to order. Entis said that while the ice cream is sourced from the same supplier as the previous Dairy Queen, their soft serve will have a higher butterfat content at about 5%, giving it a thicker texture and a richer flavor. Percentage of butterfat in the cream mixture is what it's all about, she said. Currently, the most popular ice cream is the Twister with mix-in toppings. Soon, Entis plans to introduce seasonal flavors like pumpkin pie. And if you want something fun to savor in your freezer for later, pick up frozen ice cream pies, ice cream bars, or a cookie sandwich. If you go, it's Barker's Ice Cream and More at 2100 7th Avenue in Marion. Their hours are 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Saturday. They're closed on Sundays. You can phone them at 319-377-1054. They have a website and are on Facebook at Baker's Ice Cream and More. Open for dine-in and carry-out, the drive-thru is open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Drive around to the main window to place your order. Also in the food category, Crumble Cookies is coming to Cedar Rapids. A cookie chain is opening its first franchise location in Iowa with a soft opening November 11, the grand opening November 12. Crumble Cookies, a chain with locations in 32 states, will open in Cedar Rapids on the first floor of the Collins Community Credit Union headquarters, 1005 Blairs Ferry Road Northeast, across the street from Target. Alongside staples like chocolate chip and sugar cookies, Crumble offers a menu of four rotating new flavors. For example, this week's flavors at other locations are key lime pie, peanut butter, midnight mint, and oatmeal chocolate chip muffin. Crumble began in 2017, and the new Cedar Rapids store is owned by Jason and Heather Chappell of Marion. And a new social gathering space offers the atmosphere of a bar without the pressure and complications of alcohol in Iowa City. Unimpaired Dry Bar opened October 22nd at 125 East Burlington Street. The new bar, open to all ages, offers handcrafted cocktails with zero-proof substitutes, specialty pizzas and appetizers, all the standard bar entertainment like pool tables, darts, and live music. At Unimpaired, we have simply created a space where you can have fun, but not at the expense of your health if you so choose, the new bar's website says. A place where you don't have to feel pressured to consume alcohol or looked at funny for ordering something non-alcohol. UIP is simply a place where you can enjoy the nightlife without the hangover the next day. Iowa City is Unimpaired's second location. Its first opening was in Davenport. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, November 4. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Alrighty.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.